Little Anthony here, and you're listening to Rabbi Sal Solomon on Dave's Gone By on UNC Radio.
Oh, shalom, my friends. Shalom, everyone. This is your beloved Rabbi Sal Solomon here on the Dave's Gone By radio program of the air. You know, you've heard the song Tears on My Pillow. I have tears of joy running down my talus because I am talking to the person who sang that song all those years ago. He also sang Shimmy Shimmy Coco Bop and Going Out of My Head and so many classics with the group The Imperials. I am, of course, talking about and to Little Anthony Gourdin, Anthony of Little Anthony and the Imperials, who is gracing us with his royal presence on the telephone as we speak. Shalom, Anthony!
Ah, shalom, Rabbi Saul. Shalom.
Shalom.
It's really a pleasure, man, talking to you. I heard about you.
You heard about me? What have you heard? Only good things, I hope.
Well, you know, it was good because my publisher told me, he says, oh, yeah, you're going to like this.
Well, thank your publicist very much. And hopefully you will enjoy this conversation. Hopefully we all will. Talking to the man whose book, Little Anthony, My Journey, My Destiny, has been recently published. We want you to all go out and read it, not to mention listen to his wonderful music and go still see Little Anthony and the Imperials in concert. How, first of all, the obvious question, you're in your 70s now. How are you feeling? How are you doing?
I'm feeling great. By the grace of God, I feel really good. I always tell people there's a 24-year-old guy inside me, but I know I'm 74 when I get up in the morning.
Well, do you feel differently, like when you're waiting backstage to go on, do you feel 50 or 60, and then when you hit the stage, you're 24 again?
Yeah, well, that's not just me, because what happens is your adrenaline starts flowing. And you go, when your adrenaline starts flowing, you have a tendency to do things that you probably wouldn't think you were going to do or move around. I've had people tell me, hey, you've got so much energy, you know? And that's not like I think about it, except when I go on stage, it shows up.
It does. I mean, you don't do splits or anything like that, but the voice is still, the voice is still there. It's still youthful.
Those days are gone. Long gone. No.
Well, wait. In the early days, did you try to copy moves of people like James Brown and try to be more dancey?
No, I really liked a lot what Jackie Wilson did, but I also was a great fan of the Nicklaus Brothers. A lot of the guys in the group at that time, and actually, there were a lot of Imperials, a lot of different guys. The original of the Imperials, they're not with us anymore. Only one is left. That's Ernest. But when we were kids, we were always fascinated by the Nicklaus Brothers. And then there was another group called the Flamingos. And they used to do these dance moves, and they called it footflip.
The footflip?
In the wings and watch them and kind of pick that up. And then, you know, you see one of those movies like Stormy Weather with the Nicklaus Brothers in it. And then you say to yourself, I wonder if I can do that. And then you start trying to do it. Now, you're young. And fortunately, we were athletes anyway. Most of us love playing baseball, football, all that. So we had a natural athletic movements in ourselves. So we combined the two, and all of a sudden we're doing splits, we're flying through the air, and on people's legs and everything else. And that's what we did. We were young people. But when I was young, I asked young, this thing's young, but now I'm old. I put away all those childhood things. Days are long gone.
Well, let me ask you, was there a temptation when you were first starting out, and did you think maybe sports instead of singing? Was there ever that idea of being a professional ball player of some sort?
Yeah, you know, I didn't think I was going to be a brain surgeon, and I'm just an average kid at school, so I didn't see that at all coming out of Brooklyn, and I did not at all, but I did love to play baseball. Mind did I play a lot of baseball. I was a pretty good baseball player, actually. And I had the pleasure of going to school with the great Tommy Davis, who played with the Brooklyn Dodgers. And so I got to know him. And so I just thought, when people said, hey, man, you got a heck of an arm. You're really good.
Huh.
So I thought, well, maybe that's what I should do, you know. But then one day I started singing, which I'd always done. It was very natural to me. And the next thing I know, somebody put some money in my hand to sing. And all of a sudden, sports didn't mean that much anymore. I,
Well, you're in your golf years now. Golf and chess. I would stick with those.
Golf. Still ride horses when I can, and golf. That's really what I do. And fish.
What?
Love to fish.
Wasn't it Frankie Lyman who taught you to ride horses the first time?
Yeah, he was. The weird thing about it is that we were in San Antonio, Texas. It's like around 1960, I believe it is. And he asked me, hey, we're on a tour together. You know, it was a big show, big tour show. And he asked me, hey, you want to ride horses? Can you ride? I said, you know, in show business, you always say yes. You say yes to anything. Can you do this? Can you do that? Oh, yeah, I can do that. And you don't even know if you can do it. But you do anyway, because you don't want to miss out. So I went with him to some, I don't know, place he took me where these horses were. And we started riding, and he immediately started laughing because he saw I did not know what I was doing. I was trying to follow whatever he was doing. And like a kid, you know those cowboy movies? I tried to emulate cowboys, but it was very obvious that I really had not done that before.
Now, how did you first meet Frankie Lyman? Because you were friends for the duration of his life.
Yes, still passed away. I knew Frankie I met in 1958. Two girls we happened to be fond of.
Uh-huh.
And they were like, they were cousins. One was called Taffy and Kathy, and they were dancers on a show. I don't know if you remember, but back in the day, Jocko Henderson had this TV show, and the kids would dance local. I don't think it's come out of Jersey or something. And they would have the kids dance, and we used to see, I used to see these two girls dance, and I said, man, that's really great. Forgive me.
Sure.
And so when I had to do the show, I met them, and then by meeting them, they then introduced me to Frankie, who was their friend.
Now, was he, at least back in 1958, was he still clean-ish, or had he already discovered chemicals and things?
No, he discovered chemicals a long time. Rumors are, or legend, is what I know, what I heard, he was doing heroin when he was about 14.
Hmm.
Yeah. And I mean, nobody really knew it, but after a while, he got addicted to it. So, and that was a battle for him. So day one, it was a tremendous battle. And the one thing that I loved about him, and we were best friends.
Right.
Because he never introduced me or told me, oh, let's do this. No, because I guess he knew that's not a good thing. And you wouldn't do that to your friends.
So were you able, throughout your career, to stay away from, I mean, heroin, God forbid, but even cocaine or the drugs that musicians do when they're on the road?
Yeah, I didn't do any heroin because we call that mainlining, you know, when you start stopping your arms and needles and things, you know. No, I didn't do that. But everything else that was out there, I sure tasted it.
Oh.
And like I said, by the grace of God, I should have been dead a couple of three times, you know.
Oh, so you really did a lot of the, oh boy. I mean, obviously you haven't done, I'm sure, that any of that in like 30, 40 years, but during the 50s and 60s and 70s, you were doing it.
Yeah, that's long gone. But coming up, yes, I've experienced that. Most people that I know in show business, some form or another, I mean, they're exceptions, but the rule was, that's what you did. You know, what they call sex, drugs and rock and roll, it's really real. And that's how it was passed on. And then you got these heavy metal groups, they took it to another level.
Well,
you know?
Well, sure, but what was the closest you came to, you know, a death thing of overdosing or doing something that where you could have gotten killed or etc.?
No, I never overdosed or anything like that because it's kind of difficult. I've heard people who have on cocaine. I certainly have heard that. And but no, because overdosing generally comes from, you know, if you say overdose, it's hard to kind of explain it because I remember I had a very bad experience, and I suppose that's overdose, when I was introduced to LSD.
Oh, my God.
So, in that respect, probably did. But never to the point that I was going to die. When I said that I should have been dead a few times, because of the places that I hung out,
Oh.
You know, I go to drug dens and collaborative buildings in Harlem. If you don't go in them places, you know, if something goes wrong, you get yourself hurt. And that's one of the reasons why I call the book My Journey, My Destiny, because I should have been, but I feel that God himself gave me that. He was protecting me for a reason. Maybe that reason is to get on the phone and talk to you. You know,
I don't know if God actually has a purpose in mind of you are talking to me. Maybe that would be wonderful. I think this is a little more random than God going, oh, you know, I think I'll take a break from looking after Syria and France right now. Let's put little Anthony and Rabbi Saul Solomon together.
Yeah, right. But there's so many wonderful things in my life. Well, let me put it this way. I am having more fun and more content and more at peace with myself now at 74 than I was at 24. Okay? Usually it's the other way around. You get disillusioned and bad things happen to you and all of a sudden you do bad things to yourself. No, it's just the opposite. I ended up, as I got older, life became much more meaningful. In fact, I have 9 kids.
Mazel.
I have 13 grandchildren and 5 great-grandchildren. That's not a blessing. I don't know what is.
That is it. Can I ask you, and not to bring up a slightly, more than slightly sad subject, did you have 10 children and lose one, or, because one of your children died, I think?
Yeah, I always tend to buy 9. I always include, and that's Casey, my son Casey, who was he was my middle child, one of my middle children. And he died in 2003 when we lived in Los Angeles, and he had a lot of. He used to play sports. He's very good. Looked like he was going to go all the way. But he got hurt. And when he would get hurt, they give him a lot of painkillers, you know. And evidently, he had an addictive nature. And he got addicted to the painkillers. And then Batman Jones soon came, you know, really caused him problems. And we fought very hard with him, you know, to see if we can't get him through. But what happened is that he did. He started getting his life right. But his body betrayed him because of all those years of abusing prescription pills.
How do you get over that? I mean, you know, you get old, you lose a wife, you have the expected losses. You lose the parents, you lose the grandparents, you lose uncles and cousins and things. But a child, even a grown son, how do you get past that?
I don't think anybody will ever feel grief from losing a child. It should be the other way around. I shouldn't be burying my child. They should be burying me.
Well, that's what they say, yeah.
And it is probably, especially for my wife, because he was our firstborn. My wife, Linda, we've been together now 40 years. And he was the firstborn. So it was a very difficult time, but I was very, very, I had a strong faith in me that pulled me through. And then that helped to pull her through. And we have some wonderful people in our lives that, you know, one was my pastor, Bayless Conley, who actually buried my son. And he, you know, it just was the right people were in my life. That's why I said, now is the best years of my life as opposed to when I was 24. Because at 24, I would have never been able to handle that. I wouldn't have known what I knew. And for people out there that lose their children, they know what I'm talking about. I don't think you ever, Rabbi, get over the fact that you lost a child. You just learn in time and comfort and faith that you begin to move on. You live for them. You know, and you know in your heart that your child is all right. So with all those things, the combination put together, was the thing that brought us through. And if anybody's lost a child, that's one of the things that I can recommend, that you really begin to see. Life is nobody's guaranteed tomorrow.
Right.
And we're going to face adversity. How do you deal with adversity? That's the key. That's why having the book is all about. You know, I've had people tell me when they read the book, they say it's like a history book. Yeah, it's that. Then I have other people to read the book that says like a man of redemption. So it's all of those things. And that's one of the things I try to put down in that that doesn't mean that you don't think about your child. I think about Casey every day, Mr. Bartlett. I'm more than, what would he have been at the time he was 26. Mm. Now, so I wonder what he would have been like now at 38. Because he's been away from us for 12 years.
Right.
Or 13. So, hey, you know what I realized too? Everybody's going to die, whether it's sooner or it's later. It just happened he left sooner. But we're all going to die. We're going to come to that point. You know?
Well, yeah.
And that's how I deal with it. And hopefully somebody listening to this can get some comfort out of that by reading it and see how I handled it and how my wife handled it.
Well, we're talking with Little Anthony, who is certainly sounding like a very big man to me right now. I'm Rabbi Saul Solomon, by the way. We're on the Dave's Gone By radio program talking about his life and his book, Little Anthony, My Journey, My Destiny. Now, can I ask you, I am a rabbi, so to be honest, I've never been born again. You have.
Yeah.
At what point did you have that big religious moment in your life?
I don't think I can call it religious.
Oh.
Because it was. It was a relationship. It happened in 1978. Prior to doing that year, I did a movie called Contact 303 with Mr. Henry Fonda, Chad Everett, and Billy Dee Williams. And I was featured in the movie, in other words, co-star.
Oh.
And I thought, well, this is going to really bolster my career, you know? But the movie was canceled in the middle of doing it, and I got very, very depressed because I thought, well, this is going to make life better for me and my family. And it didn't go through, and I didn't know how to handle that. It's almost like somebody's dying, you know? And you don't know how to do it. And I just was just grieving and grieving about that. And then when I was living in Redondo Beach, California, with my wife.
Yeah.
Linda, who's a school teacher, and she was at work. And I just got to the point where I just came to the end of myself. And I just was in the apartment all by myself. And I just was, it was like a giant load on my shoulders, like this boulder that I was carrying, and of depression. And I just started, if this sounds kind of weird.
No, go ahead.
I running around the room, and I started being mad at God. Like, it's almost like he knew I acknowledged who he was, his spirit. And so I was crying and screaming, why me? All the pity party thing. And all this stuff. And then finally, I fell on the floor on my face. Started crying profusely. And this is something that a lot of people will find to them maybe kind of weird.
Okay.
To me, real. I felt, all of a sudden, I felt a warm, like someone holding me. And it was love. It was nothing frightening. There was nothing fearful. It was just, I don't know, the other word to say it was love. It's like, I love you. I love you. I mean, Jeremiah said it in the Bible. He said, I knew you in my mother's belly. So I really believed that I had a destiny. And at that point in 1978, that reality came to pass. And Rabbi, I never was the same again.
Hmm. But how do you explain how some people have that tap on the shoulder, or they see the vision, or they feel that presence, and other people never feel it, or you have suicidal people, and they would love to feel a little hug, a little touch, a little something from God, and they get nothing, and they blow their brains out.
Well, in the book, it tells you when I was in another point of my life, in 1969, where I went into depression, and had a nervous breakdown. And, I mean, I lived in a place called Embassy Apartments in Brooklyn, and I was on the 24th. And I heard, not a voice outright, it's hard to explain, tell me jump. And then I said, well, what is that, you know? And then I was walking in Brooklyn up Eastern Parkway one day, and the cars kept going by, and by, it was one of those busy days.
Yeah.
And again, I heard something say jump. Now, that's some spooky stuff. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And at that point, that way before 1978. What kept me from doing that? But I don't know. Some people will just do it. But something held me back. But at the time, I didn't know what it was. It was almost like in my heart, I said, well, I'm better than that. You know, I know. And then I have a wonderful doctor. It was my father's doctor. My father took me to him, and obviously he gave me sedatives and couldn't calm me down.
Wow.
But at that time, there was no experience. I didn't get any touch or anything. But yet you hear every day, literally, people jumping off bridges or killing themselves or whatever it might be. And I was at that point, but I didn't do it. Why? Why? Now, in 1978, when I was touched, then it all made sense to me. Whoa, you know why? Because this God was with me all of my life. I just didn't know it. I didn't realize it. The bustles and hustles of life that we go through, we're all trying to make it, we're trying to keep the money, food on the table, and da, 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 da. And you're always running and you're wrapped up into this world. But deep down in us, everybody has a measure of faith. Something that this is the creator of the universe. This is him. This is what Moses experienced.
Everybody
who've experienced that. We have witnesses all over the place to tell us what they experienced. That's what happened to me my own way. And when I say I was touched, now I'm the only one to say it. Yes, I was actually touched.
Well, no, Mitt Mazel, but also you were kept on Earth because you wanted to give the world the book that you wrote, and you were going to give the world all these more years of going in concerts and doing music and you know, doing the oldies circuit and letting people still hear your voice at Joe's Pub and all the other places that you play.
Well, one of the things that I'm very blessed about is that I do concerts. I don't do oldies at all. I think what I do for a dear friend of mine, you remember the group called the Shana Ma?
Of course. Bowser Bauman, yeah.
He called me and my son, who's my business manager, and said, man, I need a headline event. I know you don't do this kind of show, but man, I need your help. Well, he's my friend. So I did it for him. But I'm getting ready to go out of here right now doing a concert in Newport News at the Ferguson Center for Performing Arts in Newport News with Miss Darling Love.
Oh, wow, Darling Love.
Yeah, and plus, I just did a CD that's been released a week ago.
Oh.
And it's called, with George Benson. We did a duet together. So, my life is so well, better now than ever because of those kind of experiences I have, and I don't have to worry about being, you know, I have to go on that circuit and somehow got to survive. No, but like I said, all this stuff is happening now, and there's a reason. You're right, Rabbi. Maybe because I can't go out there and write a book. And yes, and I can go out and sing and maybe touch somebody's life and make their life a little better because my music makes them feel better.
Well, it has for since 1958. You've been making people feel better with your music. Let me ask you, little Anthony, do you have a favorite song of all the songs that you've done over the years? I mean, maybe it's Tears on My Pillow because that was your first hit, but maybe it's something we've never heard of.
No, yeah, funny thing, I have some songs I love that were never commercial acclaimed, never was commercially acclaimed, but boxily acclaimed. In other words, some of the best stuff I ever did never was a record that became a hit.
What were some examples of songs that you love that you wish more people heard on your CDs?
I don't know. I made so many of them, Rabbi. I don't remember which one it is, but I know that I did. And on occasion, I'll hear it, or somebody will play it for me, or whatever. And I said, that was really a good session. That was one of my best sessions. I did so well. Two songs, as far as hit records are concerned, actually three. One was Going Out of My Head.
Oh, yeah.
The other one Hurt So Bad, and the other one was Take Me Back. Those three, to me, as commercial hits, were some of the best work I'd ever did.
You're not always the best judge, because at first you and the group didn't really care to do Tears on My Pillow. You were like, yeah, I'd be convinced to do it. You didn't like Shimmy Shimmy Coco Bop that much when they brought that one to you. Yeah, I'd be convinced, right?
And we're not unique. I mean, it's an Sinatra talked about when they gave him this novelty song. I forget the name of that novelty song. He didn't do it.
But I think it was High Hopes or something. That it might have been that one.
Yeah, which was, kind of silly, but he did it, you know. And even High Hopes, because it was the movie and they were promoting the movie, he didn't really want to do that song. He didn't knock him down. But look what happened with that song. It became huge. So we as artists really sometimes don't know. So when Mr. George Golder, who was the president of Golden and Records back then, that we were recording for, he believed in that song, and he made us go back in the room and learn it while we had a session.
Wow.
It was like, he gave the band a lunch break. He says, guys, get it together. I want to hear that song. And we did. I did. They did. And we came back to him in the recording studio, and we did it. And rest is history.
Well, one of the things that I'm a little embarrassed to ask about being a Jewish person is that so many artists and black artists of the 50s and 60s were not treated well by record companies and their managers and the labels, and they signed bad deals. Were you treated okay by the industry?
Okay. Not okay, Rabbi, not at all. Yeah. We got ripped off like everybody else, not only blacks. Yeah, proportionally, most blacks got popped. But I mean, all this friendly got ripped off. And one thing I know when I talk to certain artists, they all have that same story. You know, Bobby Rydell, you know, we all have that same, you know, it is the nature of the recording business to do that. And the reason why they do it is because in their heart, they feel, in their minds as businessmen, well, you're going to make all the money in your personal appearances. You don't need all of that money. And once somebody comes along and figures it out, like Smokey Robinson, Paul Anka, They figured it out. Listen, you know, when we were kids, we were in the Stone Age of rock and roll.
True.
And we didn't understand all that stuff. We didn't have the expertise that they have today. These kids today learn from us. Now they're walking into studios with a crew of lawyers. They're ready for every nickel and dime they're supposed to get.
But let me ask you then, when, you know, you were having hits, you were having a career, but you were getting stripped out of a lot of that money, and then you go on and have all these children and a wife to support and family. How did you manage, especially once the rock and roll era changed and the Beatles came along?
Well, again, we were told by the music industry that we're the only singing group, black or white, that was successful in three different eras.
Mm.
And the only other person that did that was by Sinatra. He was hugely successful in the 40s, obviously.
Right, yeah.
And then 50s, and then the 60s.
And actually, Sinatra spanned about 4 or 5 decades of success, really.
I might be missing a few. and we did it in 3. And that's one of the reasons why we were inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, because one of the things that they told us was that it was our body of work that was so interesting to them, that I was able to do all these things for so many years consistently. Now, I can't do it by myself. I had some great help, man. Mr. George Golden was one. Richard Barron, A&R man, there was one. And then later on, in the early, mid-60s, Don Costa.
Oh, yeah.
One. Eddie Randazzo was another. I've had all these wonderful people in my life that assisted me to be what I am today. So I didn't go to my own.
And let's not forget also the members of the Imperials. I mean, three of whom you still tour with from the very beginning, yes?
No. I've got to straighten that out. Let me set the record straight.
Sorry.
The Imperials were many of the different Imperials over the years. People didn't realize. Well, I don't know, but you see the pictures of the different albums, there's always one different guy. No, the original cats that I came up with, they're not there anymore. Sammy Strain and Clarence Collins. The only one left is Ernest Wright this day. I do a lot of solo stuff on my own, and I do concerts by myself, but I also do things with them, with the guys. We call Imperial. See, the Imperial, Little Anthony and Imperial has become a brand.
Of course.
So you can put anybody in
That's right. And by the way, speaking of imitating you, and people may not know this about your singing style and how that came about, it really the thing that locked you in as the kind of singer that you are had to do with pronunciation and diction, amazingly enough.
I always get on the phone, and people say, "Thank you, Mrs. Whatever Gordy." They think I'm a woman.
Oh, well.
Mr. Goldner picked that out. And when I was singing, he noticed that I was trying to be like everybody else. And I'm similar to what Ray Charles did, same thing with Ray Charles, until they told him, "Look, you got to be Ray Charles, whatever that is." The same thing to me. He said to me, "Anthony, why don't you sing like you talk?"
Oh, yes, yes. Because you were trying, he said, didn't she say, listen to Nat King Cole or something?
Yeah, he said that, and he said, I want you to try that. This was Tim Martello. When we go back in the studio. And he said, well, who's your favorite singer? I ran a bunch of people, you know, Elvis Joe, then I said, Nat King Cole. And he said, well, do you notice how Nat sings? How he pronounces and announces this enunciation so clear, and how he spaces the words to fit the song. So I didn't know what to do. So when we started recording, the first thing came to my mind was how Nat Cole would say the words. They tried to tell us we're too young, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And I said, don't remember me. The syllables were all exactly how you should say it. I didn't muddy it. And that was the beginning of Little Anthony. Literally.
Wow.
That was it.
And also the name Little Anthony, people, I mean, I know you've told these stories a zillion times, but it's always great to hear that that came from the unfortunately maligned DJ Alan Freed.
Yes. And Alan, the legend says that the record promoter came in to give him the record of Tears on a Pillow to consider, you know, being played on his station. In those days, that was WINS Wins in New York. And he was the biggest thing on the planet outside of Dick Clark. And he said, wow, that girl sure can sing. And the promoter said, well, that's not a girl, that's a guy. He said, well, my, he must be very little. What's his name? Anthony Gordine. He started saying Little Anthony on the radio, and that was it.
Little, and do you think Alan Freed got a bad deal, a raw deal from, well, the courts and the music industry?
Because what he was doing was bridging the world between races. He was literally, there were forces in the country at that time that did not want to have that. And I mean, when you go to Alan Freed concert with blacks, whites, Puerto Ricans, they're all there, you know? And they didn't want that. So they put a lot of pressure on them. Now, obviously, Dick Clark was my friend to the day he passed away.
Hmm.
But if you remember, when he had the shows in Philadelphia, all the kids were white. You know, it was like the only black folks or the minorities came on the show, whether it be Richie Ballin. We were the only ones that were people of color. But in his dance group, that whole show was white.
Hmm.
With Alan Freed, kept the opposite. It was mixed. It was black, white, everybody. And there were forces that were intent on destroying him, and they did. They threw the whole game of payola on him. Well, everybody was taking payola.
Of course, yeah.
Everybody was. You know, on the big jocks, yeah. He just was the one that they wanted to make an example out of. And they did. It killed him. He literally died of a broken heart.
And it's off. I mean, in my shul, if someone wants me to say a prayer for them, I take $20, I say a prayer. I mean, it's the right thing to do. It's a win-win, as it were.
Actually, Rabbi, between you and I and this audience, this, you know, call it payola. They just gave it another name. It's called marketing, advertising.
There you go. Exactly, exactly. Well, I'm hoping that we are helping to market your autobiography, Little Anthony, My Journey, My Destiny. How can people buy the book, please?
Well, you can get it on Amazon. In some cases, Barnes & Noble. I know in our second reprint, So you can get it on Amazon, you can get it on, oh, jeez. Yeah, you know, you...
Well, do you have a website of your own, too, right?
Yeah, my own, well, we sell it on two websites. One is Little Anthony. No, actually, you know, one website. That's Reviver Records.
Reviver or Revival?
Reviver.
Reviver Records is the place to find out about what you're doing and where you're appearing.
Yeah, I'm on Facebook. Little Anthony's on Facebook.
Oh, cool.
And that's where you can see the books, or you can get an order or whatever. If somebody's doing it, because they're selling.
Oh, mazel tov, mazel tov. Well, last question for the wonderful, delightful Little Anthony Gourdin that I want to ask. What do you listen to? In other words, I know your music is steeped in the 50s, 60s, and 70s, but what do you listen to either when you're on the bus or you just want to listen for pleasure?
When I'm listening for pleasure, I just listen to whatever I think that turns me on. Sometimes even, sometimes the rapper.
Okay.
Sometimes, you know. But I also am an opera fan, and I listen to a lot of opera. And classical music and jazz. I just, whatever music, it makes me feel good. That's what I listen to. It doesn't take much for me. I'm easy. I hear something turns me on. That's it. I'm gonna, I want to do it.
Wow.
And even ethnic music, anything, I get turned on by. And so I have a large capacity for music.
Well. You also have a large capacity for life, and we are very thrilled that you have shared that capacity with us in the neighborhood. All I can wish you is much more health, much, much more music, and I hope you live long enough to write a sequel to your autobiography, but only good things in it.
I'll break it to you and your audience. They want me to write a book, and it's called The Reluctant Icon, so that's going to be the title of it.
Hmm.
And then when you find out what's in there.
The Reluctant Icon. Well, you don't seem that reluctant. You seem like you're very comfortable with who you are and with your life, and especially, of course, where you've been for the past bunch of years. So, I don't know, nothing wrong with being an icon. Enjoy it.
Yeah, people around me said, you seem so, don't you know who you are type thing? I'm going, no, who am I? I'm actually Jerome Anthony Gourdin, and my mother's name was Elizabeth, and my father's name was Thomas, and that's who I am. I'm a father, I'm a grandfather, I'm all those things, I wear a lot of hats. So when people pat me on the back, it's very difficult for me sometimes to receive that. Like, I feel like, but what did I do? So overwhelming. Until one day, I said to my publicist, man, I feel like a reluctant icon. And he said, that's the title of the book. You see where that goes.
The Reluctant Icon. Well, we're certainly not reluctant to have you in the neighborhood. And what you do, and what you have been doing for decades, is spreading joy, making people a little bit happier when they hear their music, your music, when they read your book, and when they continue to hear your music when you perform. So thank you, Little Anthony, for being with us in the neighborhood.
I think that's what I'm on the earth for. Took me a long time to realize that. But that's why I'm here. And that's what I do. If I can make people's lives a little bit better, and it's the hectic world I'm living today, by singing a song, that's good. That's really good.
Well, it's been really good talking to you. Shalom to you, Little Anthony.
Shalom, Rabbi. Goodbye.
Bye-bye now.